Today's episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you by Native and HelloFresh. Sponsors like Native and HelloFresh help keep the lights on here at Blotter HQ, so keep an ear out for some handy promo codes and find links in the show notes. And now, the episode.
This guy has never been held accountable for anything he's done.
He wins every time.
Get ready for a cheery one, folks. Just kidding. Our review topics today, Lifetime's Surviving Jeffrey Epstein and financial crisis docuseries The Con, both deal with predators who were protected by power structures designed for that purpose. This episode might not be fast, but you'll probably be furious by the end of it. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 154. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Joining me to discuss sexual and fiscal horrors today is returning guest Omar Gayaga. Hello/sorry, Omar.
Hi, I'm like looking at the exit. I'm like, okay, can I go now? But this was some rough viewing, but actually very educational, both of them, actually. I learned quite a bit.
I think they're both well-made, but it's rough stuff. I would not leave it to the professionals in terms of watching this stuff back to back. Anyway, once again, we have two most wanted sections today. Before the first one, I will issue a content warning, descriptions of sexual assault and harm to children, because it is, after all, Jeffrey Epstein. Surviving Jeffrey Epstein premiered this past Sunday, on Lifetime. All 4 hours will have aired by the time you hear this. We have watched the first night's worth. Here's the case file from Lifetime's press page. Quote, the four-hour doc investigates the billionaire New York financier who was alleged to have used his connections to the rich and famous to shield his predatory behavior with young girls. End quote. That's about as terse as you can be about this case, but the fact is that if you're watching this show, you know the case well enough, and you know that it's likely to be similar to Surviving R. Kelly, in that the testimony of survivors is centered in the series, which is great, but also very difficult going. So I have watched all the R. Kellys as well. I think that this way of approaching this kind of crime narrative is really important, even though it's tough to bear witness to it. This felt a little bit different from Surviving R. Kelly, but overall, I found it just as compelling and striking and maddening. What did you think of what we've seen so far?
Yeah, I felt the same way. I didn't watch the R. Kelly documentary, and kind of for the same reason that I think I would have avoided this had we not been scheduled to talk about it and gave me a reason to watch it, was because, like with the R. Kelly case, I mean, I read so much about it before he was even arrested, you know, all the reporting coming out of Chicago. And then with Epstein, I had read all of, you know, so much of the Miami Herald reporting. Right. You know, this is when I worked in a newsroom and was reading news all day, and all this stuff was coming at me. So by the time Epstein was arrested, I felt like I knew that case inside and out. I had read so much about it, and, you know, and so much about the previous case against him that had been dismissed. So settled. So I felt like, I think by the time these documentaries come out, I always feel like, well, I already know all this stuff, but I think there's definitely value, and I'm seeing it now from having watched these few episodes, of just hearing the stories from the survivors themselves and not just the news narrative around it.
Yeah. I think with both series, but I found it, you know, this is the recency bias, I guess, but I also found it striking that I think this docuseries believes that part of its mandate is to explain as unlecturingly as it can how this comes to happen, like how this kind of perpetrator, how this kind of sociopath operates, how pedophiles successfully identify their victims and circle them off from the herd and groom them. And I think the docuseries feels that that is part of its like public service mandate. Would you agree with that? And do you think they do a good job with that?
I do, because there was this, a part in the first episode where I thought, oh, here we go. We're going to have the whole history of Jeffrey Epstein from his childhood to then, and, you know, trying to explain the pathology, which, you know, I just wasn't that interested in learning about him so much. You know, like we know he's a monster. We know he's dead. But I was interested in, you know, how did that network of people around him come to be? How did he meet? Ghislaine Maxwell.
I wrote this down somewhere. Keep talking. I'll look it up.
that relationship, you know, fascinates me. And then all the people around him, and how did he, you know, the how did he get away with it part of it, more than the who was he, and you know, we know his perversion. We know what his deal was. So I wasn't as interested in that as just, well, how did he get the money and how did he build the network and how did people not see what was happening? I think it does a good job of skirting around biography of him, you know, only enough to so that we get the sense of, okay, well, that's how he hooked up with this person. That's how he met the Victoria's Secret guy. It connects the dots without belaboring it and spending a whole episode just on Epstein's history, which I appreciated.
Yeah, there was a recent Netflix Jeffrey Epstein property that I reviewed for Primetimer. I don't think I talked about it on here because I think they fell into the trap of, and this is something that I talk about on The Blotter reasonably frequently, that they think they can explain or try to understand a sociopath. And it's like, sociopaths, not to be flip, but they're gonna sociopath. Like, because we, the civilians who are both trying to explain it and watching this thing, aren't sociopaths, there's only so much that trying to analyze the psychopathy does for anyone.
I read your prime timer for this one, and I think you described it as a dead end, which I think is a great way to describe it. Like, it's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah. Whereas this, and I think Surviving R. Kelly to some extent, has sort of like a two-pronged idea here, which is, first of all, to continue reiterating in many different ways that victim blaming is not appropriate, but then also to explain why a guy like Epstein can and will identify often previous victims of sexual and childhood abuse. So in clip two, one of the psychologists that they talk to explains a little bit about how Epstein and his ilk kind of like start the grooming and then raise the temperature of the interaction. So here's clip two.
A perpetrator who has a propensity for children tends to understand that they won't get what they want from fear. So they tend to use seduction. The hook was money in exchange for a simple task to do a massage.
Preying on Courtney's financial vulnerability, Jeffrey Epstein made another offer, which was, any person that you bring to me that's of the same age as you, I'll pay you a $200 finder's fee. And Courtney then began, when she was at school, she was at social gatherings with other 14, 15, 16-year-olds, when she was at the mall, making the same offer that had been offered to her, which led to Courtney probably bringing 30 other minors to Jeffrey Epstein's house.
Ooh, you explicitly mentioned this in our rundown syllabus. Do you want to talk a little bit about the show talking about the financial angle that he took?
Yeah, I really appreciated that they drew the connected those dots of even geographically of just from West Palm Beach, where some of these girls were from, you know, where there were trailer parks and they were coming from families with drug addiction and alcoholism, to just down the road, you know, to this area that where Epstein lived, that was gated, you know, gated big gates and walls and security cameras. It wasn't that far geographically, but economically, it's a whole other world. And so you had these girls who, to them, you know, the $200 that Epstein was throwing here and there with every massage was nothing to him. To that, to these girls, it was a lifeline. To these girls, $200 was a lot of money. And then $200, you know, for each person they brought in or each massage, you know, for them, it was the difference between eating and not eating, or helping, you know, a parent who was struggling with drug addiction or in jail. So that struck me big time, just that, you know, explaining why some girls were more vulnerable than others, why some girls would, you know, and I think in the second episode, they made this very explicit of, you know, that horrible argument of like, well, then why did they go back? Well, some of them, that was the only way they could find to get themselves out of a hole. But then there were girls who did, you know, who were sexually assaulted by Epstein once and never went back.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't, you know, it went in multiple ways. And I thought one fascinating thing that, and I won't jump around too much, but in the second episode, one other fascinating thing was that one of the survivors mentions that there were sort of three levels of victims or survivors with Epstein. There were the ones who were kind of the models and the ones who were kind of in that elite circle already. There were the ones at the kind of the massage therapist level. And then there were the ones who we don't even know who they all were, you know, who were locked up in these, you know, compounds in like New Mexico. So, you know, those were some things that I had not read about before or heard about before with this case.
Yeah, I think they did an excellent job illustrating the many ways that a predator like this, who unencumbered by shame or empathy, can set these situations up to his own advantage. And they talk a little bit more about that in clip 3.
He felt he had protection from the rule of law. He was not concerned.
I realize what I am. I'm very comfortable in my own skin. What I'm really free to do is I'm free to follow my own personality.
His behavior really was sociopathic. Manipulativeness, superficial charm, lack of anxiety, and predominantly lack of empathy. He made a choice to act on these sexual impulses in the way he did. And he made a choice to exploit vulnerable individuals.
There's something about the way that guy says he was unconcerned. And like, he was correct to be unconcerned, really, wasn't he, in the end? Because he set this up flawlessly to implicate people in such a way that they wouldn't turn him in.
Right. And you know, to hear the stories from the survivors, I mean, some of it was just the environment. They would walk into these maze-like, you know, New York apartments or the compound in New Mexico, and it was so overwhelming, just the environment they were in, just that it was just like a whole other world to them. The amount of money and the amount of sort of splendor on display. And then you have that in combination with, you know, him being rich, and then Jelaine, you know, with her British accent and her kind of air. And like, it just put them in a position where they thought, well, who am I to go against these powerful, rich people, you know, in this environment? It was, even the environment was set up against them. It was really just a hideous machine.
Yeah. And it really was a machine, because like, you hear about the number of girls that he had going in there a day, like, oh, and then sometimes it really is like the Las Vegas casino effect, that it's like, well, you can leave. Good luck finding the door. Here's all this confusing carpeting. These signs aren't really accurate. Why don't you play some blackjack while you're trying to find the door? Like, it's shocking.
I mean, one of the most heartbreaking of the episodes that I saw was the girl who had, you know, who was you know, crying, apologizing for leading other girls down the same path, you know, of knowingly luring them into that world. You know, that it's and we'll see, you know, we'll talk about this again when we get to the con, but just the level to which this whole enterprise relied on kind of foot soldiers, relied on, you know, people lower down the rung to kind of feed that machine. It's just really just grotesque.
And on the desperation of, you know, a teenage girl who might be the functional head of her household. Ugh, I mean, I am glad that I have the capacity to be shocked by this still, but also I admire that the series is able to remind us that, like, this really is shocking, and shock should have been a response that got some action far sooner than it was, but alas, it was not. Despite like truly mind-boggling amount of evidence on like the first search warrant that was served in Florida in 2006. But before we get into that, I'd like to take a little break for a word from our sponsor, Native Deodorant. Look, I am a sweaty person. I come from a long line of sweaty people. I spend a lot of time thinking about deodorant. Deodorant performance matters. That's why it took me so long to switch to a more natural deodorant. I thought that surely no natural product could withstand the genetic betrayal that is my armpit legacy. But I am thrilled that I was wrong, and I'm thrilled to recommend Native. For me, Native works better, and it's made better. Native has ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch. You don't need a degree in chemical engineering to read the label. And it's vegan, and it's never tested on animals. Native also never uses ingredients like aluminum, parabens, sulfates, or talc. And if you think that switching to an aluminum-free deodorant means you have to sacrifice on odor protection, think again. Native will keep you smelling and feeling fresh all day long. Native even has a newsletter that, among other things, has advice on transitioning away from traditional aluminum-adjacent deodorants. And with over 10 scents, including rotating seasonals, Native has something for everyone. Their more popular classic scents are coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and citrus and herbal. I'm a big fan of the first one, coconut and vanilla, because it matches up perfectly with the scent of the sunscreen I'm slathering on all summer. But the scents are also pleasantly subtle and unintrusive. You're not going to fill an elevator with the smell of fruit or leaves, and it's not fakey smelling either. Want to see for yourself what Native's more than 14,000 five-star reviews love so much? Good news, trying Native is risk-free. Every product comes with free shipping within the US and free 30-day returns and exchanges. So do what I did and make the switch to Native today by going to nativedo.com/blotter or use promo code blotter at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedo.com/blotter or use promo code blotter at checkout, that's B-L-O-T-T-E-R, for 20% off your first order, and that link will be in the show notes. Thanks, Native. Well, look, there's no good segue from talking about antiperspirant to talking about sociopaths, but it's what we try to do here. So back to surviving Jeffrey Epstein. I got the feeling that some of the talking head interviewees were actually still shocked and embittered at how little progress was made in the first round of revelations and lawsuits and so on against Epstein. Was that a sense that you got?
I did, and I remember, you know, even just as a person who had read some of those original stories and over the years had been, you know, This kept bubble. I mean, in news cycles and as some of the reporting was being done out of Florida, like this kept bubbling up. And I remember continuing to hear about it in those years in between and just being furious that this guy wasn't, you know, in prison somewhere. But yeah, like I, especially the guy who I don't remember his name, but the guy who was friends with Ghislaine, who wrote the song about Epstein, which was mortifying.
Oh, was my such, God, that really was.
And I'm so glad they kept that because just his face, his own embarrassment and mortification and just like, oh, my God, I can't believe I wrote this.
Yeah, he just looked nauseated. Can't believe it.
And as much as it's important to foreground the survivor stories, I feel like stuff like that had to be in there to kind of show that even these people who were worldly and presumably smart and, you know, bought into this world and bought into Epstein and believed that there was nothing, you know, untoward going on, or if they did, thought it was just some sort of weird inside joke like this guy did. It was so creepy and terrible.
Yeah. And I think that pattern recognition sometimes really works in the favor of guys like this, because you're like, this is so beyond vile that it I can't actually be seeing this. I'm not sure that's why larger charges weren't brought the first time around. I have a feeling someone who was in charge over there was also implicated and was more than willing to just drop these down to misdemeanors, as you hear in clip four.
The shocking thing was the amount of evidence, things like Amazon receipts for books about sex slavery, flight logs, message pads that had message after message of little girl calling in, I can bring this friend tonight for a massage. I can't go because my grandpa has a birthday. Things that shock the conscience.
What you had in this investigation was a rock solid prosecutable case against a serial sexual predator.
And you just have to assume that someone in that power structure down there was on tape, or they had records, and this is why he was protected. I don't know.
And I believe it was one person. It was a judge that put the whole kibosh on it, I believe. I mean, allegedly, whatever. But I believe it came down to one person's decision to not move the case forward, right?
Yeah. And then I think the charge that he wound up with, which was like a fine and a warning not to do it anymore, was like, I don't even know, promoting prostitution? So, ugh, God. I mean, I hope Ghislaine talks, because I really think that this is just so widespread, and this is why it took so long to get the guy.
Yeah, yeah, there's that.
He had dirt on everyone. So the Les Wexner thing is something they dig pretty deeply into in the Netflix Jeffrey Epstein property, but I am fascinated by the fact that this guy who like got kicked out of a bunch of different places, like a bunch of different workplaces, including a girl's school in Manhattan, and always had like some story about how like, oh, they didn't fire me, I quit. And then he and Les Wexner kind of adopt each other. And the next thing you know, Epstein is a financier, even though it seems like he's actually a kept man. Are you as sort of fascinated by this relationship and how central it seems to Epstein's ability to machinate as I am?
Yeah. They didn't connect the dots as well in this documentary as maybe they did in the Netflix one. But I mean, the sense I got from the history that I saw in this one was that he was at the school. He left the school under weird circumstances. And then all of a sudden he's on Wall Street. And I don't think they mentioned Wexner until later as his like primary financier client. But I got the impression that happened, that came along later. I didn't know that was who kind of took him out of, you know, that world and into Wall Street. So that does make it more fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, I think he was doing some like boiler roomy things, and then when that didn't end well, like Epstein got out of it scot-free, but someone else did like 18 years in jail. And I think it's a condition of this guy's probation that he participates in these documentaries, because he's in all of them, by the way. But he was the one we heard earlier saying that he was unconcerned. But yeah, this relationship is, I think, so key to understanding that we can't really understand Epstein, because he just has this, develops this power over people. Here's a clip talking about the Les Wexner chapter.
Les Wexner was the owner of the Limited brand, which is Victoria's Secret, and a very, very wealthy individual.
By 1991, Epstein had not only become Wexner's financial advisor, he was his only client. What was even more bizarre was that Wexner signed over power of attorney to Epstein. This was essentially allowing Epstein to do absolutely anything in relation to his financial affairs. And if you're thinking this is a weird arrangement, that's because it's a very weird arrangement.
Les Wexner had bought and renovated a house on East 71st Street. And then the next thing we knew about this house was that Jeffrey Epstein had moved in. And the story going around was that he had just given it to Jeffrey. What is it about the relationship between Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein that would inspire him to make such an extraordinary gift?
The way Les Wexner looked at Epstein was with, like, puppy dog eyes. I think if Epstein could love, the only person he loved was himself and Les Wexner.
Or Les Wexner's money. I'm fascinated by not really the relationship, but how it sort of Epstein leveraged it and the money in it to become this person who was in like the party picture pages of Vanity Fair.
Yeah. I still didn't get a good sense of who, what Wexner's motivations were, or what his connection was beyond, you know, maybe it was as simple as a father-son-ish relationship, and you know, and that was as much as there is to it. But I mean, yeah, it feels like there's more there, and I don't know what it is.
Yeah, the Netflix documentary makes it plain that they think the relationship was romantic / sexual. So,
oh, okay, that I didn't know.
But I feel like that's still not all of it, and I think that so much of this is where the money comes from that allowed Epstein to set up this disgusting machine that you were talking about earlier. But a lot of it was just the sociopath's unerring instinct for identifying the girl who's not going to, the girl who thinks that she deserves this. And one of the survivors talks about that in our last clip.
Beginning 3 days after my 8th birthday, I was first sexually assaulted. And that happened repeatedly for a long time. I learned back then that you just kind of suffer through it. You suffer in silence. Growing up with that experience, it definitely set me up for being there in Jeffrey's office, pretending like it's not happening. I've got to a point in life where I felt like, this is what happens to you. This is what you're here for. Like, I'm that object to be used.
I mean, it's just devastating and depressing. But at the same time, I appreciate that this series and Surviving R. Kelly's commitment to making this explicit, to making this plain-spoken connection, and to taking that burden off of the survivors that way. And it's also well made. It's good storytelling, but even if it weren't, I would appreciate that it gives this gift to the survivors and also like explains to the audience that let's not blame anyone but Epstein.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like I said before, I wasn't that interested in seeing this, and I'm glad to the degree that you can be glad to watch something like this. That I got to see some of these stories firsthand instead of just, you know, having read it as news stories. I think giving voice to it, it just sort of gives you a small sense of the scale of the potentially hundreds or thousands of lives that he, you know, if not destroyed, that he at least altered the course of and you know, sent in these damaging directions. So yeah, it's devastating, but yeah, I think it definitely treats the survivors with a lot of dignity.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point too, that another thing these series do is like just the sheer volume can be like really daunting in terms of engaging with these stories. But, you know, putting faces and names and voices is really important, and it helps us, the viewer, sort of find a way in to a story that can just seem like, I mean, there were so many of them, and he was so rich, and what's the point of caring about anything? And this does a good job sort of putting your hand in theirs, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's good, but it sucks, if you know what we mean. So it should be available on the Lifetime app now. That's Surviving Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, it's rough, but I recommend it. It's well done. All right, so also rough, for different reasons, is our second most wanted section. And in this one, I don't think I pulled any clips with this, but the documentary does deal quite extensively with suicide and mentions of suicide. So as always, listen with care for yourselves. The Con is a 5-part series about the financial crash of 2008, but it sort of has tentacles in all directions. The Con is a little tough because, first of all, the name is quite vague, and second of all, it's in virtual cinemas, even though it's a docuseries. So you kind of have to make the effort to seek it out. I think Omar and I are on the same page that you should. But first, here's the case file from The Con's website. Quote, The Con is an in-depth investigation into the 2008 financial crisis, 9 years in the making. Who did it, why it happened, and how our country went from of, for, and by the people to of, for, and by the corporation. And what's past is prologue. The heist of our democracy that includes fraudulent practices, massive credit card debt, student loans, auto loans, and the revolving door between finance and government is still going on and will become even worse than before. End quote. I wish I could disagree with any of those assertions, but I cannot. We watched the first two episodes. General thoughts, Omar?
I really liked a lot of it. The first thing you think of, or the first thing I think of when you hear about a doc like this or a story like this, is The Big Short. You know, mm-hmm. that's sort of the first go-to reference, and it's not that, for sure. It's not trying to make comedic hay out of it or trying to kind of satirize anything. It's very straightforward. It has great interviews, I thought. It has really good sourcing. You know, it definitely has a journalistic, as a journalist, I admire just the level of sourcing they got, that they got the right people to speak on these things, that they hit it from so many angles, that they focus on the stories of people who were affected, who are the most compelling, not just who they could get, but the ones who were really should be foregrounded, and that really, you know, make the documentary kind of have that sort of emotional impact. I had a little bit of quibbles with things like, you know, just the title sequence, which I thought was a little up tempo for what they were, a little too cool for school.
Yeah, a little Ocean's 14. Yeah, that was a little.
It was a real weird. Yeah, it was completely jarring compared to what the rest of the tone is. And then we'll get into this, I'm sure, but it's sort of hosted by a guy, Patrick Lovell, who is, I guess, an investigative journalist who lost his own home in the mortgage crisis. But up to where we had watched, they haven't gotten into that. He keeps alluding to it and saying, you know, people like me who lost their house, but we don't get that story, which I imagine, you know, will either be the conclusion or will come along in much detail later on, which is good because what they do lead off with is way more compelling than his story could possibly be.
Yeah. I agree. This is definitely well-sourced. I think that you can never go wrong re-explaining how we got here when it comes to like subprime like loan packaging. Like, it's really complex derivative stuff, But on the other hand, this series' argument is that actually it's just straightforward, like, forgery and stealing. Like, this is actually not that complicated. Like, when Wall Street gets involved and you sort of cross the, you know, the permeable barrier, then it gets a little, like, dense and academic. But I think they do a good job explaining it. The graphics are, like, a little repetitive, a little, you know, it's crazy wall stuff. It's a little predictable, but I think you don't want to get too artsy with this topic. And I agree that they got a ton of people from all sort of corners of this fraud to talk to them. Here's one lady who they sort of like, they basically like just weren't picking up the fax machine so that she could rescind this loan. And then they just ran the clock out on her with the statute of limitations. But on top of that, the documentation that, like, they would have gotten caught because they were quite stupid about it. Here's clip 7.
Or a Cougar. And they're saying, I owned a 2000 Grand Prix and a 99 Cougar paid outright, and they're worth about $30,000. I didn't own those cars. And my name was Rebecca Weesey, but here it says Brenda. They kind of forgot as they were forging who they were signing.
And so you recognize right away, this is 8 years after the fact, that that's not your signature.
That's not my signature, and it's not even my name.
Well,
and
what was your reaction when you figured that out for the first time?
I called the police, and I made a police report, because this is new discovery, and I was told I needed new things in order to pick this back up with an attorney. I took it to an attorney, and they basically told me, you know, what do you want us to do? That was 8 years ago.
Statute of limitations.
Statute of limitations.
This poor not Brenda woman, like, her marriage, like, went asunder because of all this, because she just became obsessed with proving that this lending company, like, just was, you know, shuffling papers and defrauded her. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it was for some other reason, but they made it sound like her husband was like, you got to drop this. And she's like, are you fucking kidding? So,
yeah, it's a lot of money. And it goes on and on that she was one of just thousands of people that were taken in by these companies. And, you know, it was desperate mortgage people. It was CEOs, you know, drawing money out of these companies and with no intention of staying, you know, at these banks long term. It was, you know, and this was a new angle that I had not seen covered as much in all the stuff that I had read before, just the degree to which minorities were targeted.
Yes.
You know, whole communities and churches were targeted by these banks because they knew that these were an easy target. And, you know, yeah. The documentary, I think, very smartly leads with the story of a woman named Addie Polk, who is a 90-year-old woman who shot herself in the chest as they were coming to foreclose on her. It is absolutely tragic and heartbreaking. But then, you know, as it goes on, you know, it wasn't even that she was being foreclosed on legitimately. Like, they were forging her signature. They took out loans that she was not even aware of. And by the time we got to the second episode, we realized it wasn't people coming to her door and convincing her. It was people like doing this behind people's backs without even their knowledge or signatures. You know, they were forging signatures. They were creating loans, and who knows where that money even went. So at first I thought, oh, well, she must have had medical expenses or she needed the money or something. No, she never even got the money. Like, it was the levels of fraud here were that, you know, it wasn't even desperate people taking out loans because they needed the money because they were in crisis. It was that they weren't even seeing that money. People were doing this, you know, forging identities and faking signatures. It's ridiculous and crazy. So, and they keep coming back to her. And every time you see her face, it's like a knife in the gut. I mean, it's very compelling, her story, and you know, very smart to lead with that and then keep coming back to it as a reminder of, like, this, you know, they may have pulled the trigger on her, you know, at point blank. I mean,
yeah,
they killed her.
The episode, you know, is called Who Killed Addie Polk, and it's clear who they think did it. And there's, you know, a bunch of candidates. I want to jump ahead to clip 10 because that's where her minister, Addie's minister, and others are talking about the targeting of minority and low-income neighborhoods. And in the second episode, they return to that idea, and I assume they're going to keep returning to it. Here's the clip, and I think that this guy, I wish that this reverend were the Patrick Lovell instead. Because I think he has just better, I don't know, camera presence and insight into some of the real problems here. Just my opinion. Maybe they'll turn it around in episode 3 or 4. But anyway,
my girlfriend asked me to say that he's no Morgan Freeman as far as Patrick Lowell, like as far as narration and presence and magnetism. Like usually he's no Morgan Freeman. I'm like, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, where's the lie? I don't see it. While we're mulling over the many people who are not Morgan Freeman, here's clip 10.
You would have to wonder why lottery machines are prevalent in our community. You would have to wonder why there are so many places that sell alcohol. You would wonder why so many churches are located in a small geographical area, because the people have no hope. They're living day to day. You know what? I'm going to sign this paper because my roof is leaking and because my stairs are crumbling. Those companies preyed on not just the people, but they preyed on the circumstance the people were in.
Too often, it's not told that it's minorities they're targeting, because nobody cares. Well, I cared. And it also, if it was a felony 3, in some cases, it made it a felony 2, because you're targeting minorities or the poor or people that can't fight back. And we have an interest in that.
That last guy was an investigator for a task force that it just took a really long time and a heap of evidence and them having to like relearn all these statutes about fraud and larceny. And still not that many people saw the inside of a courtroom. And I appreciated that that guy just like called things what they are. That he's like, yeah, they can get away with this because people don't care about, you know, systemic crime leveraged against minority communities. Well, I care. But then, you know, what he could do about it was limited.
Yeah, I bless those dudes in Ohio that actually did, you know, that did the legwork and did the, you know, the months and months of investigating to bring some part of it down. And then, you know, I think it, the con does do a good job of sort of spotlighting those heroes. You know, there was the whistleblower woman who was asking too many questions. There's mm-hmm. the guy that was brought in as a guy to kind of raise the profile of Countrywide and then got summarily fired for asking too many questions. There's the guy who you know, the SNL guy who helped bring, you know, kind of put the SNL crisis to a standstill before it got even worse. You know, that I think it does a good job of showing not just, you know, oh, this is horrible and it's just nothing but monsters, but no, here's some actual people who did something or tried to do something or tried to blow the whistle or get ahead of this. I think, you know, those sources are just as important to see how they were trying to fight these crimes or expose them and what it did, you know, what it got them, which in some cases, you know, the woman who was the whistleblower at a financial institution, you know, she can't even get hired. I mean, it's just, it does show the consequences of that and the people who were trying to do something about it.
Yeah. Was that the lady who was like, I am a private person. I don't want to be on camera. And yet, like, I keep doing these documentaries and explaining that we tried. This was not something that people were unaware, but it was like one or two of us against a system and, you know, of people who outrank us and people who threatened our livelihood. And a lot of people were making money and they didn't see the harm. And, you know, what do you want from me? Like, I don't want to be on camera, but people have to understand how this happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they did a good job of drawing the parallel between the SNL crisis and the mortgage crisis and how they were similar and how they were different. And then the other detail that I wasn't aware of, you know, was just how many thousands of people were being hired just to rubber stamp, you know, how many appraisers and mortgage brokers and, you know, kids, you know, who'd been delivering Domino's pizza previously and now are making tens of thousands of dollars on each deal. It's like these people were, you know, and there's a great quote somewhere in the second episode about, you know, they were not hiring the best of the best. They were hiring literally the lowest of the, you know, the lowest tier of employee you could hire because they were so malleable, because they would say yes, they would approve every loan. And the idea was to get as many loans as possible, no matter if they were going to default or not. And you just wanted yes people, you know, people who would just push this stuff through.
Yeah. Fund them.
Insane.
That was a really good segment in the episode.
Oh, that's a great detail. Yeah.
Like, well, what about if they're... He's like, do they fog up a mirror when you hold it up to their face? Fund them. Like, wow.
That guy with the tan. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. He is the tannest.
Yeah, there was a lot of good moments like that. And you know, as much as I had an issue with just some of the framing and the narration, it's like I said before, it's just great sourcing, great interviews. And my only complaint was that some of those interviews that I felt could have just been interviews and, you know, talking head interviews without the let's walk through the park and take a weird angle behind the guy's head. It's like, what are you doing?
like writing with a pen and paper. At the coffee shop, like, okay, I don't, you know, this is B-roll and I don't think we need it. I do want to talk about their, something you referred to before, which was their explanation of like the vertical nature of the fraud in some cases, that they just like everybody is on the same payroll and it's just like a vertical line straight up to this guy who's going to foreclose on the house and then like buy it back. But before I do that, we do have another word from another sponsor, HelloFresh. What is HelloFresh? Get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door with HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh lets you skip those trips to the grocery store and makes home cooking fun, easy, and affordable. HelloFresh's recipes are really delicious, you guys. HelloFresh offers lots of recipes to choose from each week to help you break out of your recipe rut, which is definitely something we've been suffering from as we enter month 295 of quarantine. There's something for everyone, including low-calorie recipes, vegetarian recipes, and family-friendly choices. The ingredients are fresh and high quality, and 90% of them are sourced directly from growers, so you get the freshest recipes delivered to your door. We were really digging on the brown butter rigatoni in our box last week. The end result made us feel really fancy and accomplished, but with no stress. The instructions are clear and exact, the pictures are actually helpful, and we didn't have to meal plan, go to the grocery store, or worry that we'd have those odd lot ingredients left over. Plus, we were done in about half an hour, and we probably saved money. And we could feel good about eating sustainably. The pre-portioned ingredients meant we wouldn't waste food. The packaging is almost entirely made of recyclable and or already recycled content, and HelloFresh's carbon footprint is 25% lower than store-bought grocery meals. Plus, HelloFresh understands that life and schedules are unpredictable even when everyone's at home. You can add proteins or sides, you can change your delivery days or food preference whenever you need to, you can even skip a week. And larger box sizes make feeding the whole family easier. More servings, more savings. If you're ready to experience America's number one meal kit for yourself, go to HelloFresh.com/blotter80 and use code blotter80 to get a total of $80 off, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply, so please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. That's HelloFresh.com/blotter80, BLOTTER80, for $80 off and free shipping on your first box. HelloFresh.com/blotter80. Thanks, HelloFresh. And HelloFresh actually is something that you ask to come to your door, unlike some of these predatory lenders who were literally doorstepping people, which I was like,
segway.
It's crazy. But then the con does a good job explaining not just the pitch, but why it works and how hard it is to wriggle out of it once you've signed for the first time. Or, I mean, if you even sign, but yeah. So here's clip 8.
Literally knocking on the doors of homes in Akron or in Cleveland and saying, hey, you know your house is worth $90,000 even though you only owe $30,000 on it? And this is a house that perhaps they bought for $20,000. Here's what I could do. I'll write you a new loan. Your mortgage payment's gonna go down, and we're gonna wrap in all this credit card debt that you owe as well. And don't worry when this loan adjusts, because if for some reason your rate starts to go up, you just call me back and I'll write you another one. And that's a cycle that went on and on. To the extent that people were getting rich. I was getting calls in my private law practice, and then ultimately later as a state senator, from people who wanted to be mortgage brokers, but they couldn't get licensed because of their felony convictions. That was the kind of people that the mortgage industry was starting to attract.
I found that particular clip striking because it sort of parallels these girls who go and sort of recruit at their high school to give Jeffrey Epstein massages, in that like these are desperate people who see an easy way to get ahead quickly or more quickly, and you know, in desperation, you tell yourself a lot of things. So I thought that parallel was striking, like that, you know, people in dire straits will rationalize a lot of things. And in this case, you know, the CEOs absolutely created this culture in some cases where it's like, all right, everybody fake these loans. Let's do the volume business. I will plunder the stock options and then shut down the company. But I don't know. I did feel some sympathy for these like ex-cons who were like, well, I can do that.
Or college students or people who this was their first job ever, and they don't know that they're destroying lives. They don't know that they're not supposed to approve loans. You know, they don't know that. I mean, you only had that come in where you had people like appraisers who were supposed to have a degree of independence. And, you know, there's a very striking moment in the second episode where there's like an appraisers convention and this guy's like, you all knew what was going on, right? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, they were force pressuring you to, you know, to push through these bad loans, right? And they're like, yeah. Like they all to a one, you know, knew this was going on and were losing business because of it. Because if you were a legitimate appraiser at that time, you know, turning down things or evaluating them for what they really were, you know, you were being blacklisted. It's insane.
That was super interesting that this investigator still seemed kind of not tickled, but like fascinated by that. He expected that appraisers were taking bribes, but actually it's what you said, that if they didn't go along, they wouldn't get the business. And that where they were really making money was the referrals and the repeat business.
Right.
Oh, no, it's only worth 40 grand and they wanted to hear 140, then they just wouldn't call you anymore. And then you have to go work at Domino's. So.
And then it goes up to the level of the actual bank saying, well, we're doing what this other bank is doing that's crooked, because if we don't, we're out of business. You know, like all of them rationalizing that, you know, we're only following the Aqualife? What is it called? What's the one with the blimp?
Not Aqualife.
What's the name of that huge company? AmeriQuest.
AmeriQuest.
Yeah, and so basically they were the cockroach that escaped from the SNL scandal, you know, the only one that wasn't convicted, and formed this huge business in mortgage on the same principles that the SNL ones got brought down on. So it was the one guy that escaped from the SNL crisis, crawled out of that and started this new business, and boom, everyone else is following suit because it works like gangbusters when you're doing fraud. So that was real super interesting, drawing that line, which I had no awareness that was where that originated from, was that really AmeriQuest was out of the ashes of the SNL crisis and formed anew, and then everybody followed that model, and that's what happened. I mean, it's crazy.
And I didn't know that either, and they did a great job illustrating that, you know, it's it's like you used to read in when there would be like yet another expose about steroids, but everybody's just on deep background and no one will say it for attribution, except Jose Canseco, who's like, look, it's literally an arms race. He's like, people have families, everybody else is doing it, you have to do it to keep working.
That's what the banks were saying. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it was a cockroach in the graphic, but it should have been like a little cockroach scuttling out of the wreckage.
It really should have been. They also picked unbelievably unflattering pictures of these CEOs, which I respected.
I noticed that. But then the one guy who was like the guy who brought down the SNL, like he was like a hero mugshot.
Yes.
Great photo with him. I was like, this guy's good. But I mean, I you know what though? Like they were heroes. They were trying to bring down these billion-dollar corporations and at their own peril. I mean, these were companies that had the means to really, you know, hurt them or come after them. So yeah, all respect to these investigators. But one thing I just wanted to say about it was, if you've bought a house or a condo in the last 15 years, so much of this will bring up memories of like, oh yeah, that guy did try to pressure me to get an APR in 2004.
Yeah.
or that guy did seem real sweaty and desperate when he was trying to get me to sign this thing. Like, you will remember those instances. And I bought a house 2 years ago and I was remembering the appraisal coming under the value of that the bank wanted. So like, I'm like, well, good for that appraiser. They were doing the right thing. But I remember distinctly in 2004 when we were buying a house, being pressured to try to get an APR. Like, oh, well, we can bring your mortgage loan down. You know, your payment will be lower and this or that, and the rates aren't going up, so you won't have to worry about it. Like, we were like, no, we're doing fixed. Sorry.
Yeah. No, we had the same. And we bought in 2009. And that was the only reason we could afford a house in Brooklyn, is because the economy was complete garbage. And also the house was a money pit. Oh my God. Like, that movie was a documentary. Anyway, we still were like, the appraiser was like, they're charging what for this? Interesting. The following things are up to code because that list is shorter. We were like, great. But like, we had to be very aggressive with the down payment, and still it took our guy like 2 weeks to find a bank that would give us fixed rate, because they just were like, oh, okay, a musician, a writer, and a math teacher. Arm it is. Like, no.
This arrangement only works on sitcoms for a nice, spacious place. It will bring up memories of stuff like that. And then I think back on it, I'm like, that guy was really young to be a mortgage broker, to be a guy in charge of this much money. He couldn't have been more than 25 years old. I'm like, oh, that's what was happening.
And then when we refinanced, we read every single page, and I thought the notary was going to kill us. But it's like, look. We've seen most of these documentaries. We're reading every single page.
Yeah, well, that's the highest praise I can give this documentary, is you will learn stuff, and it is and it's still entertaining. Like, it's you. I mean, I thought I knew how the SNL stuff worked. I learned new stuff about that. I thought I knew how the mortgage crisis worked. I learned a lot of new things about that, because it goes into such detail. And you know, I didn't know about any of the investigation that went on in Ohio and that whole task force that actually did some good. So there's really good stuff here. If I have any issues with it, it's just, you know, very cosmetic framing and hosting issues with, you know, that I think are not deal breakers at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think that, you know, as I've said, there's some pedestrian production values, but this is also one that, like, you may have to just sort of sit and listen to it so that you're absorbing everything. But I think it's worth the money. I think usually there's a list in at the con.tv website. It'll be in the show notes. There's a list of virtual cinemas where it's playing. Pick one near you that you want to support. And it's $20. You have a week to watch it. I think it's worth it, especially if you need reminding, not just about how these financial frauds work, but also how freely these fraudsters sort of move in and out of official treasury positions, and how
Oh, God, yeah.
The DOJ sometimes, like, performatively does not care about these crimes. So, yeah, I recommend it. It's good.
There's a guy who they say is, you know, he was an ambassador, and they go, and he died a billionaire, and you're just like a dagger through your heart. Like, no, I want him to suffer. No.
Yeah. So, I think that was the cockroach guy.
Yeah. Wasn't it? It was the guy, was it the America Quest guy? Yeah, I think so. And he died without getting any punishment at all. Nope. He died super rich.
Yeah. All right. One last clip, which is what I referred to earlier. Just the one of the many excellent explanations of how schemes work sort of further down the rungs of the ladder when everything was flowing up to the CEO. Like, this is how you physically get the house valued at X and then loaned out at Y. So here's clip 9.
The key with Mr. Willen was that with each house, you're finding the same people making the repairs on the house. You have the same people selling the house and the same people appraising the house. As time went on, the houses would be foreclosed on. After foreclosure, Mr. Willen would go back and buy the same house that was foreclosed, cosmetically make the appearance of the house look to be more valuable than what it was, and resell it to another victim. And it just perpetuated as time went on.
So, yeah, it's a monopoly, basically. Except it's all one property.
Sucked. These guys sucked hard.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we will make you angry. That's the thing. Like, by the end of the second episode, I was furious, but it made me want to keep watching, weirdly.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Are you going to keep watching, do you think?
Yeah, I want to see the rest of it. I mean, I feel like I learned enough. I mean, learned a lot from these two episodes, and I want to know more. I mean, I feel like that hopefully there's some more bombshells that I'm not aware of, or things that you know went on from that. You know, I have no idea where it's going from here, but I'd like to know more, because I think it's important history that a lot of us just don't know, recent history, and it's still happening. I think if nothing else, it will make you more apt to recognize when these sorts of schemes are happening around you. Like, I'm going to be much more aware when I see people with no experience whatsoever handling my financials. I'm like, hey, can we get someone with, you know, a little gray in their hair, please, to manage my mortgage or something?
Well, and, you know, speaking of that, like, if it does nothing else, it will remind you, keep an eye on aging friends and relatives and make sure that they're not being buffaloed by stuff like this, and B, never ever ever sign something you didn't read.
Yep.
Ever. Speaking of reading,
in local news today, bees.
Omar, where else can listeners find you and your work?
I've been writing a lot for Medium. They have if you're not aware, they have a set of websites on specific topics. Like, they have a tech site called 10. They have one about culture called Gen. The one I've been writing for a lot lately is called Level, and that is a site geared toward Black and Latino men, kind of around my age, in their 30s and 40s. But they do a lot of fun stuff too. We've been doing a lot of rankings. I ranked Jarritos sodas recently, the best
Jarritos
sodas. Very controversial. Oh my God. I got my family. My kids do not like tamarind, and I love tamarind, and it got heated. We did a whole taste test around the table with 9 different sodas, and we were like super sugar punchy, and it got real heated. Pineapple won. Pineapple is the best Jarritos flavor, bar none, and I've heard no one disagree with that.
I would not disagree with that, but I mean, team tamarind also. Sorry,
I had to put tamarind in the middle of my list because I was one out of the 4 people. I was the only one who didn't think it tasted like dirt, so I had to say it was controversial and put it in the middle of the list. But if it were up to me, tamarind would be like in the top 3. But So I've written a lot about kind of racial issues more than I ever used to, and stuff like that for Level. They're a really cool site with a really interesting sense of humor. You should check them out. So it's just level.medium.com, and you can find a lot of stuff there. And my old 21-odd-year website, Terribly Happy, is still around. I still update it once in a while, but that has survived Blogger, WordPress. It wasn't a typepad site ever, but I used to hand code it. Oh my god!
Me too.
That alongside Tomato Nation and a couple of these other old school blogs that are still around.
Formerly of the SpryNet universe, Tomato Nation. I'm so old.
I remember the transition from Blogger to whatever, I think WordPress or whatever, was so traumatic at the time. Like, is my site ever going to survive? But it's still around and kicking. Terriblydash-happy.com is that. But I'm most active probably like on Twitter and stuff. So Omar G on Twitter.
Outstanding. I'm sorry that this was so grim today, but I think
I learned so much though.
And at least really they were both good. So thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, that's it for us today. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, The Vow, which is about Nexium, and Love Fraud, which is about love fraud. Toby Ball hasn't been back in a while, so he'll join us. And first-time guest Andy Daynart of Reality Blurred is going to come by to talk about love fraud. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on Twitter and Instagram, and on the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Today's episode was sponsored by Native and HelloFresh. Please check the show notes for those links and promo codes. My guest was Omar Gayaga, and he is on Twitter at OmarG. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.